So what day of the fucking quarantine is it?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I'm not really keeping track.
Have you started, like, doing a diary of some sort?
I want to start journaling more.
Yeah.
I think that would be helpful because, I mean...
What else is there to do?
Because who knows? Like, if we do that every day, we might have, like, a new classic, Journal of the Plague Year, Part 2.
Hmm. Are you that interesting? Is it that... Are you that interesting to make staying within the same four walls interesting?
Well, I hadn't really thought of it until now. Probably not. How are you feeling, Demir? Like, tell me... well, actually, I don't... Whatever.
I don't really care. I mean, we're on group chats all the time. You know how I feel. I don't know. You know, the most interesting thing about the plague years is I feel like it's been the kind of... the testiness on among friends. That's the thing I've noticed the most, perhaps. I feel like people are really on edge. It's like it's getting to them. Conversations just sort of blow up in ways that I don't particularly expect sometimes, though I feel it. I feel the tension in every conversation. Like, so I'm not like really surprised when it blows up, but I'm like, whoa, it blew up when
That's
it happens.
That's actually really interesting. I don't know who I was telling the other day, maybe my parents, that I am feeling that, actually, I think it might have been my therapist.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll talk about that. How's therapy in the age of plague? Are you teletherapying?
Man, that's funny. Yeah. Yeah. Video conferencing. I guess everything's video conferencing now. And, yeah, but I am sensing that there is a bit of a divide on the group chats that I'm on that, you know, because I mean, these are matters of life and death at some level, and people will take things more personally. And also there's a kind of, I don't want to call it virtue signaling because that actually diminishes it. I think it's totally legitimate, but I think people have different conceptions of what's appropriate to do or not to do socially. And if you disagree with them, if I disagree or they disagree with me, whatever it might be, there's a personal tinge to that because it means that we might be threatening public safety.
The collective.
Yeah. So what I do as an individual is now a matter of public concern.
Spoken like an American. Look at that. Like, as an individual, there turns out there's a society.
Who would have thought? Just so I just tweeted randomly. I didn't even think that this would be even vaguely controversial. I tweeted a picture of myself working on my laptop last night smoking shisha.
Saw that.
And then... I mean, luckily it wasn't most people, but there were a few tweeps who were like freaking out. Like, how can you actually set this example as a public figure? You're encouraging people to smoke, and we know about. And I'm like, wow, I hadn't even thought of that.
I didn't follow your tweet, so I just hadn't thought of it until you just said it.
Yeah, because so I was like, listen, I'm doing it in my own home. I wouldn't recommend people to smoke shisha elsewhere if they don't know where the shisha is coming from or whatever. It just like people, that was an example of what you're saying. People are on edge, and I think all of us are on edge. I'm on edge.
So, I mean, this applies much more to you than me, but do you feel as a public figure more responsibility to not say things in public and things like that?
I should have done as a public figure in scare quotes.
No, but you are. I mean, you have, what, 160 million Twitter followers? That's pretty public. Like half of America follows you.
Oh, wow.
No, but seriously, it's a serious question. Do you feel like some sort of extra responsibility about it? Like, do you remember there was actually the CDC? Yeah, the CDC had some. This was maybe about like a week and a half ago said like, and it wasn't like two public intellectuals, but it might as well have been. It said like, don't use words like the plague because it freaks people out.
Oh, really? I didn't see that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. They were like, yeah, don't talk about it with the P word.
Okay. So.
I still to this day, I don't really abide by that. But again, I don't have 150 million Twitter followers, so I don't know. Do you have a certain kind
Look,
of like
I'm
extra
careful,
weight?
I am careful about anything I say regarding coronavirus because I don't want anyone to model how they approach it after me. I make my own decisions as an individual, and I'm responsible for myself. I don't think that I want people to be reading my Twitter feed. And if I'm saying, oh, the social distancing measures in place in DC are over the top, you know, we should be more free in our movements. I don't want to get into that because, God forbid, I can't imagine who these odd individuals are who would be following my Twitter feed and being like, oh, I'm going to ignore the CDC. Instead, I will follow the great expert Shadi Hamid.
Right.
But, you know, you don't want to take chances because people who like me or friends of mine who follow me and care about what I say or whatever, you know, so I do take that, you know, somewhat seriously. And I have tried to avoid tweeting about things I'm not an expert on. So I'm not going to make judgments about, you know, what's that word?
Epidemiological?
Whatever.
That one.
Epidemiology, I think.
Yeah.
But I am, you know, but one thing I do want to write, and I'm working on an article now that I shared some sneak peek paragraphs with you, Demir, on political implications of coronavirus and how that affects right-wing populism, left-wing populism. So the things that we normally talk about and normally write about, obviously coronavirus is relevant in that respect.
I look forward to talking about it because it's a tough one. I mean, I feel like that there's sort of two strands appearing out of this. It still hasn't, I think, gelled in as a sort of conventional wisdom which way it's going to go. But it's I mean, why don't you walk through some of your sort of thoughts as you're, you know, in the midst of writing this, and we'll try and unpack it. But it seems to me that it's a real moment of trying to wrap our heads around exactly what the implications are of this.
Yeah, so I'm torn, and that's part of the reason I want to write this article, because it's a way for me to kind of think through these competing interpretations. And we don't really have anything to go on because people can talk about previous previous academics, yeah, previous epidemics or pandemics.
Similar, almost synonymous.
Almost. You know, so it's the Spanish flu of 1918, or, I mean, that's not comparable because, first of all, the death toll and the number of cases was much higher than anything we're likely to have in the coming year. So it's hard. We're talking about apples and oranges here. But, you know, so this is really new. It's certainly, there's nothing comparable in our own lifetimes. So a lot of this has to do with how we as individuals, what our tendencies are in times of crisis. So that's one thing that I want to look into a little bit more, is how do individuals respond to inflection points or these exogenous shocks? I mean, 9/11 maybe is vaguely comparable, at least from a psychological standpoint, at least for some people who were very affected by it, maybe, if you were in New York, for example. But that would have only been for a certain period of time. I think the lasting effects of this are going to be much more consequential because of the economic devastation that will take, I think, quite a bit longer to recover from. I mean, if we're talking about 5 to 10% GDP contraction in the second quarter, I mean, that's unprecedented in our lifetimes, well, right?
So let's just talk about the sort of reactions and sort of on the moral sphere. I think you tweeted today. You did, right? The David Brooks column, the recent David Brooks column about
how like pandemics make us worse, or pandemics kill our compassion too.
Right.
And you know what? That happened in previous pandemics, fine. But, you know, we're in a different era where we're more connected. We know through Twitter how other people are experiencing this. We're also more democratic as countries and as nations. You know, certainly the U.S. is more democratic than it was in 1918, but also Europe, there are greater, the welfare state is stronger. So in that sense, citizens are tied to each other, even if they don't want to be tied to each other, because if the welfare state and the healthcare system collapse under the strain of coronavirus that will affect every single citizen in a way it wouldn't have in quite this, at least in quite the same way, nearly a century ago. So I think that our societies have changed in really fundamental ways.
What struck me about that David Brooks column is, and what strikes me about you just talking about it this way as well, is that, on the David Brooks thing, on the one hand, there's a kind of, I don't know, that's going to sound harsher than I intended, but like a kind of maybe, well, no, it's not fair to call it moral preening on David Brooks's part, but I would say that there's something about this idea that, the pandemic strips us of a kind of moral goodness that other crises have allowed sort of to shine through. Whereas to me, I don't know, there's something more honest about the plague. It reduces us to our sort of least socialized, most sort of authentically human beast-like characteristics, if that makes any sense.
It does, but is that really who we are? So you're saying it strips us down to our essence.
Yeah.
Is that our essence?
Well, I guess what I'm struck with what you're saying is that this concept of progress. I mean, I always look at things like the social welfare state and the European, all these layerings of sort of civilization as really thin layers on top of something that actually come off pretty easily. You know, maybe it's for my own sort of, but that is basically how I approach the world, is that we have a very thin veneer on everything.
Yeah, but when you put humans in unnatural settings, so let's say you put humans in quarantine or you put them in something close to total isolation for 2 months, how humans behave as a result of that is not, in my view, their natural essence, because we were not made or created or whatever to be in isolation. So that's going to have a distorting effect on the human spirit, on how we, on our own interactions with the things that we care about. So I guess I want to call into question this idea of a pandemic stripping us down to our authentic selves. I think we're more authentic when there aren't pandemics.
No. Maybe it totally makes sense. Maybe what I'm trying to get at, though, it's not that it's maybe authentic's the wrong word. I would say just constant. That it brings us back to something that shouldn't be surprising to anyone. And when David Brooks cites the kind of literature, the flowering of sort of sentimental literature outside of other sort of catastrophes, and contrasts it with sort of the mute silence of something that came after the Spanish flu. Though even I think he there is being a little melodramatic, because there's several theories of why there wasn't that much literature about it at the time. Not that we were all just made into beasts, but
so we should just say for people who haven't read that column. So David Brooks is basically saying that more than 650,000 people were killed, much more than, I guess, either of the two world wars, at least American citizens. But despite that, there hasn't been any kind of artistic creation dealing with the legacy or the aftermath of the death that resulted from the Spanish flu. So it's an interesting, and he poses this question as a puzzle, why hasn't there been more reckoning with that moment in American history, considering the death toll and how much it affected families all across the country?
Yeah, right. And so it's sort of, again, I don't really want to go into these things too deeply because I haven't really worked it out that much. But what struck me in that column is that, and what struck me in what you're saying right now as well, is that like, well, you know, you're ascribing a lot of sort of weighty change to how societies have developed. And it seems like you're somewhat hopeful that, you know, we won't be as easily stripped down to our sort of barbarous essence anymore. That these bonds that we've created, like, I don't know, more democratic societies and things like that, that these are fundamentally have somehow, you know, reshaped us as human beings. I don't see that. I mean, I see, again, honesty, authenticity, those are not the right words. That's not what I'm looking for. I don't want to even impart some sort of virtue to this sort of stripping away of society. It's a horrible thing. I just see it as all of this as I'm watching it, it just sort of seems that if not truths, certain sort of verities that are forgotten by people who truly believe in progress are revealed. That's all I mean. Certain sort of essential truths about human nature are being revealed as such this as? Stuff goes back. Well, such as, you know, this kind of selfishness and fear and how that motivates human behavior. That those to me end up being, I think, if you're not taking those two into account and not taking, you know, mitigating factors that alleviate selfishness and fear, you know, and are appealing to some sort of concepts of virtue that exist outside of society, you're missing it. You're completely missing it. Now, again, I'm sure we can get into a really deep one here about, you know, religion and transcendence and the human spirit. But I mean, as you know, I'm neither religious nor a particularly transcendent person. So that's why, as all of this is happening,
okay. Well, to me,
it's why, as I'm watching all of this happen, I'm while shaken to the core at how quickly it's happening and how everything seems to be unraveling, at the same time, I feel like it's revealing something that far too many people just have written off, like we've transcended this, like we are, that's it.
Don't get me wrong. The selfishness and the fear are very real. I mean, I think what we share is that we both have a darker view of human nature.
Yeah.
And part of that has to do with our countries of, I don't know, I wouldn't call them origin.
My original origin
or yeah. whatever, you know.
Well,
you,
my origin, certainly.
You, Croatia, yeah. Me, Egypt, because at least our parents, I'm born here, just FYI to people. I'm not saying like, you know, yeah, America's my country, but Egypt plays an important role in how I understand the world, because I've lived there. I've seen I saw what happened there. And that has an effect that you can't ever truly let go of. And we're shaped by those experiences. And I think Egypt isn't necessarily a conflict zone, or it hasn't been in a way that Croatia or, say, Bosnia or Kosovo, and we have our Bosnian and Kosovar friends who I think have a different reaction to coronavirus, because for them, walking into the street, there was a risk of dying.
Right.
If you walked into the street, the death was always there. It was never particularly far away. And that you could never completely transcend that experience. Right.
Right.
So I guess I would say, look, I mean, I think that my sense is that there's sort of a bell curve going on here. That if you have very high death tolls, that's when you would see the every man or woman for themselves kind of dynamic, because that would propel us into a different kind of situation where it really was a question of surviving day to day, and people would have to do things that they wouldn't want to tell their children afterwards, you know? And we know about those kinds of situations where people have to make very difficult decisions in war zones that really challenge, you know, conceptions of moral philosophy. So if God forbid we got to that point here where hundreds of thousands of people were dying and death was there and proximate in a way it isn't quite yet, then that would be a test. And I don't want to know what the answers to that question are.
No, of course.
But if hopefully we can, we don't reach those worst case scenarios and we're able to flatten the curve, so to speak, then that's a different kind of situation that falls short of the kind of war zone kind of, you know. So,
but before we, because yeah. I know, you know, I do want to get to where you're headed with this, with the sort of the political implications on, but before we get there, I do want to just maybe unpack and get your thoughts on this. Cause the part that, you know, I have been, again, running joke on this podcast about avoiding Twitter, but I really have been avoiding Twitter as much as possible because it's horrible. It's hard. It's
yeah.
very hard, and it warps you. I feel like my pulse goes up. It's awful. But I pop on once, not every day, maybe every other day, to just point out, you know, and it's partly to get a reaction because I know it'll get a strong reaction, but to point out that this is first and foremost an economic story. And, you know, obviously this is a humanitarian and a human catastrophe. And so it is on the surface somewhat insensitive when I say that on Twitter, but it's Twitter, so you can say it briefly and then get a rise out of people. The point is, though, it is to me, actually, I'm not saying it purely to be a troll. To me, again, getting back to this, yes, you're right. Hopefully, perhaps even likely, we won't get to the mass catastrophe sort of thing. But what's striking to me, and this is going back to this sort of stripping away things, what seems to me what's happening, it's that there's a kind of perfect storm seems to be happening right now. The extent to which we've shut down everything, and not just in Washington or in Washington and San Francisco or in Washington and San Francisco and New York, but across Europe, Europe is shut down. The United States will probably be somewhat shut down, if not as wholly shut down as Europe, within 2 weeks, let's say, as this thing builds momentum, if it keeps building momentum, as it seems to be. This is beyond unprecedented. I think everyone who's spending so much time trying to figure out how many people will die, they're missing that nothing has ever happened quite like this before. Wars happen that destroy productivity, but wars also require massive production and, you know, compensating things. We're shutting down everything in a way that's just never been tried before. And the consequences of this, again, the reason why I say it is the biggest economic story, because the to me, we're talking about shutting down and tearing apart the very fabric of society in a way that's never been done before.
Yeah, but that's not an economic story to me. When you talk about the fabric of society, what I'm thinking is that, look.
But go on. Please.
No, so, yeah. I mean, look, I think the underlying fundamentals of our economy are strong enough. They'll rebound, maybe not as soon as we would like, but at some point, the social fabric and how individuals contend with isolation, with being deprived of the human touch, if we want to be somewhat sentimental about it or grandiose. But I mean, some people will be deprived of the human touch for, you know, somewhat long periods, I suppose. And or just being around their friends or being you know, being in a social setting where they feel comfortable and reassured. So, I mean, I worry about what that does to people over time, because if we're talking about a lockdown that lasts 4 months, 6 months, and God forbid, and I don't even want to say this, but I did read that Washington Post article that we shared on our group chat, that this, if we're flattening the curve, that doesn't mean, like, there will still be cases to some extent, possibly for 12 to 18 months from now.
Right.
There'll be a dip in the summer, but then there could be
a resurgence
of cases starting in the winter again. So if we're talking about having some degree of on and off social lockdown for a year as a kind of worst case scenario, that's going to really fuck with people.
I agree. I guess
I don't even know if we can do it. I don't know. Is that even plausible? That would be an unprecedented social experiment. I don't think we're even capable of doing that.
My main point is that to me is just seems like a very small part of a much bigger story, which is that, you know, the real nightmare scenario is that, okay, sure, Trump announced however many hundreds of billions of dollars of support right now. I would guess this is the first of many, and they'll all fail in the next 2 months. They'll all fail to buoy the markets and to basically save most of the businesses that still exist and are operating on a cash flow sort of basis. And these are not just small businesses. I mean, the entire tourism industry, hotels, all of this.
But, you know,
and you know, when people say to me, and you're hardly the only person to say, well, the fundamentals are sound and will rebound. It's not thinking, I think, enough of this exogenous shock as maybe the equivalent of a life-threatening virus. If one thinks of the economy as some kind of living organism, that basically, yeah, sure, you were healthy yesterday, but now you have coronavirus and you're going to die. You know, like, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about like a systemic sickening. Again, it's not clear to me that it's necessarily going to happen like this. There are many scenarios that, you know, okay, well, the governments will do whatever it takes and et cetera, et cetera. But I think there's a much larger than small chance that we're headed into territory that is completely unknown at this point. And, you know, the reason I wanted to throw this in, because I do want to talk about the political stuff, and I know you're coming at it from the sort of individual psychological level, but I don't want to lose this systemic element of what politics will look like after, because I do think that the ways that sort of we're going to end up talking about this has to take both of those into account. And I think the way it's going to work out, it's going to be how those interact. It's a very complicated question because political psychology and the psychology of individuals and all the rest of that will be shaped by how this system evolves. But as I look at it right now, if these subsequent patches to an economy that's been actually turned off keep failing to, you know, keep it on the most bare life support, which is what's going to be required for the next X months as we wait for the curve to be flattened. All sorts of things are going to change, you know, from employment to citizens' relationship to the state that is handing out money to keep them afloat, to just a sense of growing panic as all the sort of other elements of society that aren't just families and friends and the rest of it just wither and die. I think you're looking at potentially massive social unrest if this gets out of hand. I don't know. These are my nightmare scenarios. They're not growing death tolls. Death tolls are an element of this, but they're almost scenery to this bigger like societal disease that I'm really concerned is coming along.
Oh boy, Demir. Oh God, I can't do this. Oh my God, you just look. It's what we're all feeling. It's a sense of dread. This sense of foreboding that things will never be the same again. I don't want to overdo it. I don't want to be dramatic.
Yeah.
It's early on.
It is.
But I can't even describe, and it's what everyone who's listening to this podcast, unless you happen to live in, I don't know, whatever the countries are that haven't had coronavirus. I don't know, the Maldives. No, the Maldives probably has a couple cases. The Seychelles, I don't know.
Yeah. We'll put it in the show notes. We'll Google it afterwards.
We'll Google. But like, I think we're all feeling it. And that, anyway, but here's what I'll say. Let me try to get back on track and to resist the temptation to fall into utter despair.
Okay. Sorry. I'll pull you back once you've climbed
that
again.
Demir.
Go on.
And honestly, the one thing that I've realized, and I told you guys this, I think, when we were having dinner last Thursday at Astoria, not to name check DC restaurants, but
hey, they need all the support. Astoria is terrific.
Well, I think it's must
one
be
of the one of the really good.
Now.
Yeah. Well, maybe they're doing carryout. In any case,
yeah. But look, I told you guys, like I told you and Ani that there's something very, like, you realize there's something very special about those close friendships, because if we're only going to be hanging out with like 3 to 5 people, cause, and maybe that will even stop if there's full lockdown, but like if I have a couple of you guys over at my place, or we come over to your place, and we should say, just so people are aware, that me and Demir are actually doing this in real space in his living room. And that might change, actually.
It may. Yeah.
But if there's a full-on lockdown, I mean, there's about, like, well, I don't know, what, like 8 to 10 feet between me and you, so we're observing social distancing measures.
Didn't shake hands.
Didn't
even make eye contact when we walked
no
in.
No eye contact. But it really does. And then we, you know, seeing you guys over the weekend and just in general, it was, there was something like very powerful and meaningful. And it just, I don't like, certain things matter more now. And this gets to my bigger point.
Yeah.
That I think is worth emphasizing here. And I don't know about the economy. I'm not an expert. Who knows what'll happen? Even experts don't know.
No, they don't.
Economists tend, you know, economists do have a record of getting things wrong before things go wrong. So, hey, whatever.
I just want to throw in, because our friend Ben Haddad said this right after I think Trump was elected. It says, you know, the role of pundits is to explain everything that's happened up to that point. And that's what we're good at, is like, well, obviously we're here and here's 50 reasons why we got here. The most successful pundits do that in a way that suggests a kind of forward leaning wisdom, but that's, it's just sleight of hand. But anyway, go on.
Yeah. So what I'm trying to tease out in this piece that I'm working on is I'm already shifting in my political priorities. I'm changing, and now I'm just one individual, and I'm somewhat idiosyncratic in how I respond to things. So I don't want to presume that there are millions of people who feel the way that I do, but it's just my experience and what I feel. I've never longed for normalcy as much as I do today. Mm. And I'll probably long for it more in the coming days and weeks and months. And that's different because as recently, and this doesn't mean that I'm changed, my fundamental ideological convictions are still there. My starting premises are still there. But it's just to say that my priorities are changing, at least for the short term. At least for now, while we're facing this unprecedented crisis, I don't want political revolution. Or maybe I do, but I just don't have the stomach for, I don't have the energy to think about deep structural reform. And any people who have followed the podcast or read my recent work know that I very much, my theory of the case before coronavirus was that we needed to address the deeper structural problems in our country. And Trump is a symptom and not a cause. And he is a symptom of these deeper problems with the status quo. And that's why we can't go back to normal. We can't go to the status quo ante. We can't go to the pre-Trump days and pretend that Trump was merely an aberration. That's what I said. And that's sort of what I still think in some broader sense. But now all I want, I'm fine with suspending the political revolution. That's not the number one thing for me right now, which is interesting because some people have responded rather differently than I have to this crisis. And they're saying this shows that we need a political, social, and economic revolution, that we need to have the Bernie agenda in all of its glory. We need to have Medicare for all. We need to be radical. We need to see opportunity in crisis or whatever it might be. And I don't know, does that mean that they are different than I am in how they respond to crisis? Because all I want is to go back to the way things were a month ago. And I don't need to have, or maybe that could be speaking from a position of privilege, but obviously like I'm covered, I have health insurance. So there's also a stratification issue there. And there will be people who will see that as a revolutionary demand that has to be had like now. Okay. You know, those are all understandable caveats, but just speaking as someone who's experiencing this crisis, and I just want to be normal. I want to go out, it's not about, I want to go out with my friends. I want to go out to a restaurant and not feel like the world is ending. I want to be able to visit my parents and go to Pennsylvania in a couple of weeks, which was normally what we would do because I haven't seen them in about a month. And we try to see each other like every, you know, every 6 weeks or so, give or take. Either they come here or I go there. Those are the most important things to me. My friends, my family. I also don't want to work from home. And just to kind of, on a lighter note, you know, just to kind of, you know, lighten the mood a little bit, I don't think that working from home is particularly great. I think it's a productivity suck. I think anyone who claims that they're more productive working from home is lying.
Hmm.
And I challenge them to a duel.
Well, maybe we'll have more duels now. Maybe the social stigma about dueling will be lifted in the laws. Well, no, but let me ask you a little bit about that. How does this translate, this thirst for normalcy, into politics? Because, in a way, as I'm hearing you speak right now, I hear exactly the kind of complaint that, dictatorships have always tapped into, in the sense of the world's crazy, and I speak to you, and I am going to protect you, and I am going to restore things to the way, well, maybe they were, if it's a sentimental kind of thing, but maybe that mutates over time to the way things should be. I mean, this is the most fertile ground for that. I mean, on the one hand, I imagine you're just saying you'd no longer be that conflicted if Biden won and replaced the populist Trump, and you have a sense of going back to the status quo ante. So that's my one question first. How do you grapple with that, and have you thought through that? The other question I have, go ahead and do this one, and then we'll get
the other. Okay, look. So Biden winning, it's not my preferred. He wasn't my preferred candidate. Obviously, not thrilled about his candidacy. I think he's probably not a particularly strong candidate. But I think he's not going to be a strong president. So if he wins, if he manages to beat Trump, I think he'll be a caretaker president who won't do much and won't really, you know, he'll just be a sort of like, hey, let's kind of be normal, or let's try to be normal, whatever. So those are my critiques of Biden. But, you know, he's not a deal breaker in the sense I would still vote for him if he's the nominee. So he's still within the context of democracy, where what you're saying is that authoritarians make arguments about chaos and conflict, and that, hey, you know, life is the way it is, so you got to buckle down and accept a bad situation and protection and security and all that. But I don't buy that because...
And again, I'm not saying that you're going to get, you know, Trump making the case that vote for me and I'll abolish Congress. That's not how it goes, right?
Look,
or not even
yeah.
Trump, but like any, and let's just, you know, any sort of budding authoritarian leader, you know, leverages this feeling, this expression.
Right,
this,
but that's very different because I'm leveraging it for just to say that I want to go back to normalcy. That's still within the context of democratic competition. It's still, I mean, Biden is not somehow a less democratic option if people vote for him than anyone else, right?
No, certainly not.
So in that, you know, and I think we've seen that authoritarian regimes aren't necessarily better at dealing with coronavirus. And, you know, this is where I do have a little bit, and I'll, you know, I'll be straight up about this. I do have a bit of anger, if not more than a bit of anger, towards the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese regime. For the simple reason, and we know this and it's documented, that they suppressed information about the virus in the critical early days and weeks. And that allowed it to spread, at least somewhat undetected. And they suppressed and detained and disappeared, or whatever it might be, citizens and doctors who were speaking out and saying, something is fundamentally wrong here, and the Chinese regime is not telling us that this is spreading. So this is, I mean, if we look at the core of it, we're talking about an authoritarian regime that is somewhat responsible, not through malicious intent or whatever it might be, just, well, malicious intent in that they were suppressing bad information, and that's what, and they do it through force and coercion and through arresting people. And people can say whatever they want about Trump suppressing information or not coming to terms with the reality of the gravity of the situation, but no one was disappeared for saying that Trump was understating the severity of what was to come. And this is why democracies at some basic fundamental level will always be preferable, because I want to know what's happening in my country. I don't want to be in the dark. And so anyone who's drawing a moral equivalency between Trump and the Chinese regime, I'm sorry. Like at some level, I'm not going to be okay with illegitimate arguments that are just silly and tendentious. And look, I mean, the stakes are high. And I'm going to be, I'm not going to let people get away with arguments like that.
Now, again, to clear the air.
No, it's not you.
I know. But let me just
let you don't believe this.
I don't believe it. No, but the reason I asked the question, and I want to just sort of pull you back to that, because I think it's not, my question was certainly not, do you all of a sudden prefer authoritarianism more? That wasn't the question, just to be perfectly clear. The question was, as I was listening to you speak, and I'm wondering, as you hear yourself speak in these terms about this desire for normalcy, is there anything in that rhetoric that, not for you, but that if extrapolated from you to, well, let's say everyone, that gives you pause about where we're headed politically? What I'm asking you is, like, and this is why I brought up Biden. Do you think that the natural desire, that if you take everything you just described and extrapolate it to everyone, is to a centrist Democrat? Or does this put the society as a whole on a slippery path to potentially something else? And I'm not saying that you elect someone on those lines, but I think you have an openness, a general openness towards these sorts of things. So everything that people may have been saying about Trump being on a slippery slope, and however overstated and that may have been over the last 3 years, you do have a guy who does have these sorts of tendencies. And now you have a situation where people are like, oh God, you know, daddy, make it better, right? And it's that kind of set of impulses that gave me pause listening to you. Again, not saying that you're abandoning democracy. Not that any of us are abandoning democracy, but that's not how it happens, presumably. No one willingly does that.
Oh, that's not my... Okay. Look, it's a legitimate concern. It's not my number one concern right now, this kind of slippery slope towards authoritarianism. It may be. I do worry about delaying the presidential election as... there's some debate about who... Wait, it was it you or Ani who brought this up over dinner last week?
I don't remember, but it was one
someone,
of us.
Yeah, whatever you brought... Yeah, and I was like, hey, shit, yeah. Delaying the election. But, you know, at some point, if we don't have the mechanisms to vote by, like, I don't know, technology or computers or whatever...
Sure.
Which we probably won't.
Right.
Then, hey, that's a legitimate question. Like, if... Because there's a legitimacy question either way. If you hold the election on the day and there's a virus that is killing people in real time, then you have a legitimacy question that some people will not go out and cast their ballot because they're afraid. And that could distort the normal or the natural.
Right. All those categories are absurd, though.
Yeah, it is absurd. But also... If you delay the vote until some later point, then you're not gonna, then that raises legitimacy questions too. So either way, there's going to be a question that whoever wins didn't win rightly or correctly or whatever, or bigly or whatever.
You noticed Trump in like the last two pressers has been, whenever they've asked him about it, he's been very keen. They ask him about primaries getting moved and votes being canceled. He's like, very bad, bad. I don't like this.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
It's happened twice now.
Yeah.
At least twice that I've noticed, might've been more. But that's just an interesting little side note to that. But yeah, go on.
We look on the broader point, though. I don't know.
Well, okay. Let me ask a slightly different question then. Maybe this okay, will but go on.
Let me try to give voice to it before I forget what was in my mind.
Sorry, go.
Social unrest. Look, if it gets really bad, then all bets are off. And I don't want to speak to what that might look like. If we're talking about massive social unrest, I have a little bit of trouble envisioning that because maybe my imagination isn't strong enough. But if the virus is really getting bad, are people really going to be protesting side by side in close quarters? I don't know. Maybe they care so much about the cause that
I don't think it's protests. I think it's riots. But that's
But like, I don't know. Are people going to riot in close quarters, or like, do you riot keeping 6 feet between you and the other person who's rioting? I mean, how does that even work?
I think the emotion of the riot takes over. I don't know. I'm not a riotologist.
I've been to a few punk rock shows. But look, if it gets to that point, then I'll reassess my position. But right now I'm actually encouraged by the very vigorous Democratic response from critics of Trump, who called him out and took him to task. And I think to Trump's credit, at least in the last couple of days, and I don't know how long it's going to last, but he has actually seemed to have shifted his approach somewhat in saying, hey, this is very serious. He hasn't acknowledged that he was wrong, and that's probably expecting too much. Yeah. But has he understood at some level that it's more serious than it was last week or the week before? Certainly. I think some of that is because the criticism was very strong from the media, from people in his own administration, from the CDC. And luckily, he hasn't been completely oblivious to that. So that to me actually is proof that a democratic system can actually work in these kinds of situations. Not perfectly. What I do worry about, though, is there could be a clamor for, and this is not the worst thing in the world. I mean, I'm a critic of it. And even I am long, and I said this like half jokingly, but no, maybe, yeah, but also half seriously on Twitter. You know, I'm longing for technocrats. I'm longing for just basic competence. I'm an anti-technocrat. I've been a vocal opponent of technocracy as a concept for a variety of reasons, and we've talked about some of them. But, you know, if this leads to more people saying, hey, no, fuck it, we just want technocrats. We don't care what their ideology is. For people who are managing a crisis, that wouldn't be the end of the world. But if that became the normal, the new normal, that's where I would be concerned, because after the crisis, God willing, dissipates whenever it does, and we go back to normal, whatever that looks like, I don't want us to have a particular emotional attachment to technocrats or technocracy, because I don't think that they are appropriate for normal politics.
Yeah, no, for sure. Do you have any more, how do I put it? The other thing that struck me as you were saying, about this desire for return to normalcy, you sounded a lot like, like a never Trumper, like faced with the election of Trump. I think you and I have agreed that there is no going back to the status quo ante before Trump.
I want the status quo ante before coronavirus.
No, I get it. Like, I get it. But is there a status quo ante before coronavirus? How do you see that? Well, I mean, again, there's so many variables. It's so unknowable. But, you know, let's try and sort of maybe in the last few minutes start teasing what the implications of this might be. Let me say, at the magazine, you know, at the American Interest, that's really what we're grappling with right now, is trying to figure out what kind of pieces to solicit, how to even ask the right questions. That, you know, everyone's trying to figure this out in some sort of way, but I feel like our role is to think about this with an extra level of dispassion, and at the same time some sort of analytical rigor and try and sort of imagine what the implications are. So,
okay. So I'll say something, but I do want to, I'm curious what you would say to this. I know that you're sort of trying to work through these issues and your thoughts are somewhat unformed, but I would be curious to hear what you think about, is it like, what does returning to normal look like a year from now or 6 months from now or in the summer or whatever, you know, or so on the Never Trumper comparison, I think it is important to say that this is not comparable because, and I think that one thing that I hope will become more clear to people is like the Trump impeachment trial or thinking that Trump himself before coronavirus was an existential threat to everything we hold dear or Russiagate conspiracies or even the non-conspiracies or whatever we thought Trump actually did in real life factually. The smallness of some of those debates, I think, is at least to me rather apparent. And obviously, I have a bias, and I'm not a neutral observer because I was obviously a critic of the some of the over the top anti-Trump alarmism, and that, you know, oh, American democracy is dying, and all of these things. Beforehand, but it just, the fact that we were willing to, the impeachment trial just seems sillier in retrospect. Like, this should clarify the mind and folk, you know, we should have some perspective as to what's important. That was not existential. This is existential. People dying is existential. So I just wanted to say that, but mm-hmm. like Demir, I'm curious, like on that question, what are your thoughts?
So a couple of minutes ago, I gave the really the darkest scenario of, like, you know, the danger, I think, is that we've uncorked with this. And again, I'm not criticizing the quarantines or anything, because I also full well understand I'm not like that douchebag on CNBC who was saying sacrifice the old people and keep the economy going, that's all that matters. It's not what I'm saying at all. I don't know if you saw that clip of that guy. This was like about a week and a half ago. He was saying basically, you know, people are overreacting about the human toll. We have to save the economy. Old people be damned.
Rick Santelli on CNBC or whatever.
Shithead. But like, yeah, that's not what I'm getting at. But I do think we've uncorked something that's potentially very big and could have far-reaching consequences that could do a lot of damage. However, on most days, in fact, when I'm not on Twitter too much and I'm not getting sucked into the sort of quickening spiral of doom that is the news these days, I do think the United States is sort of uniquely well-positioned to weather this. You know, sort of slow out of the gate with an understaffed and incompetent president, fine. Not going to deny any of that. It potentially could get out of hand here, and we could have several Italys instead of one Italy. But at the same time, there's a kind of flexibility and pragmatism to the United States that the very fact that we have a bumbling federal government, I don't think we're that much worse off than any of the European countries at this point, even though we're a couple of days behind them. You know, just take the testing thing, for example. This might be a conspiracy theory. I don't like really retweeting it because I have no idea. But it's interesting.
Tell
because
us a conspiracy but theory.
It's a conspiracy theory because it's getting peddled on Twitter. But most of the links are to journals, which I'm not competent to evaluate. So again, I don't vouch for it, but I've seen a handful of these pointing to the fact that in fact the testing protocol in China has offered a lot of false positives, for example, that the tests that the WHO is putting around that, you know, I think the Germans developed and are going on are perhaps faulty. So we're operating off of really weird data. So, okay, this is not an excuse that, you know, we've bungled our testing. But like anything else, I think the core strength of the United States is the ability to sort of improvise these things, to have tons of different centers of activity, not directed from any one center, working on a problem from many, many different angles. That's always been the strength, I think, of America on many different, call them vantage points, you know, whether it's sort of the political element of being more flexible to addressing the needs of different people of a very vast and, pluralistic, disparate country, to, you know, I think just dealing with crisis. I mean, you know, even when you look at things like World War II and, you know, unprepared for war and all of a sudden, you know, barge in, admittedly, towards, you know, after a lot of fighting has already happened. But, you know, to tip the balance in a truly massive national effort. I'm not saying that national unity necessarily amounts and comes out of this. I'm not that optimistic. I think also all sorts of things have changed. But at the same time, I do have a kind of sort of low-level optimism that keeps me from sinking into deep depths that about this kind of adaptability of America, that I think if any country is going to come out okay out of this, it's going to be the United States, the economy be damned. And, you know, with consequences that come out from that, you know, and then the only other thing that I do think is going to be a consequence out of this is that the, you know, keeping aside the internal domestic politics, which I don't have a strong opinion on. I don't know how that works out in the United States. But I think conflict with China is now even more inevitable than it was before. You were tweeting my colleague Andrew Michta's piece about China and about, you know, calling shit shit when it is and assigning blame. That's doing really well. It's really hit a nerve. I think that's right. I think that's one of the other things that's going to come out of this, especially in the United States, maybe not in Europe, maybe not in some of these other countries.
Demir, I'm so glad. Okay, this is, I love what you just said. And just, okay, I don't want to get emotional, but one thing this has made me realize, although probably realize isn't the right word because I already knew it, I love this country so much. I love it even more now. And it bothered, look, she had some, there were some legitimate points in Applebaum's piece that how the coronavirus is showing how we are behind and we're completely ill-prepared and we'll get so many things wrong. I actually, I don't want to say I'm completely the opposite. I do have some concerns, and she raises a few of them in her piece, which is worth reading as a different perspective than my perspective or your perspective, Demir. But hearing you talk right now, it does comport with a lot of what I feel about where we are as a country, bumbling a response as we had, there has been something very inspiring that because we don't rely on the state, because we don't look at the state as a savior, that local governments, state governments, individuals, civil society organizations, restaurants, whatever you name it, we do, not all the time, but some of the time, we do what needs to be done in a time of crisis, and we try our best, at least some of the time, at least some of us, enough of us, I hope, to do what's right. And it allows for a kind of, as you said, adaptability that maybe not, we don't necessarily need the entire country to be on lockdown. And our federalist system allows different states and different localities to do different things depending on the local context. That to me seems like a promising model. I could be wrong. I could be wrong. We'll have to wait and see. But what I have seen, and this gets to a broader question of what does a pandemic bring out in us? Does it bring out the worst or the best or something in between? You know, I don't know. It's probably something in between. But what I have seen so far is something quite a bit of solidarity, quite a bit of fellow feeling. And I feel like what this disease, this virus has threatened, it threatens me, it threatens my loved ones, especially my, you know, parents, older people we know, whatever. And it threatens our economy, as we've talked about. It threatens our country. At some level, this is an attack on, it's an attack on America. And I want to defend my country, and I want to do what I can to mitigate the spread of this virus, because this is everything. At some level, our country, our society, our fellow citizens, this is everything we have and all we have. So this is, you know, not to get, again, this is being a little bit over sentimental, and because I'm a little bit emotional, I'm kind of perhaps descending into some overwrought rhetoric. But I think we have seen signs of this also in Italy. Of course, Italy doesn't have the adaptability or the federalism necessary that we have. But you do. There is this sense that, you know, we do come together in democracies, you know, with our fellow citizens. And there, I don't know. I think I haven't fully formed these ideas, but I think that there's a sentiment, and I've tried to express the emotional tenor of what I'm feeling, even though it's not necessarily cogently realized as a set of specific or clear policy ideas.
Mm.
Tell me what you think about what I just said. I know there's a lot there, and I know it's, yeah.
Yeah, maybe it's on the level of democracy. My instinct is that we'll fare better than all other democracies.
Oh, because, I agree.
Because, again,
that's because there is something, and this is just me being biased. I know you don't share the same sense of like American exceptionalism and nationalism or whatever you want to call it that I do, but I think it's moments like these that actually make me feel more American and more proud of what we have and how we're able to respond to crises for all our faults.
There's that Bismarck quote, right? It's where Walter gets his
which Bismarck quote?
Isn't that the God has a, is it fondness or special providence for fools, drunks, and the United States of America?
Oh, I'm actually not familiar with that one.
Yeah. No, that's the famous one. I think that's where special providence comes from.
Okay.
Right. So I don't know. That to me is, you know, if there's an exceptionalism there, it's, I like how that ends up sort of phrasing it. It's that it's a form of that, what Churchill also said, right? It's like always count the Americans to try all the other options before coming to the correct one.
Oh, that's the, yeah. Oh my God.
And we so, are... yeah. But anyway, so I think it's important for you and all our listeners, myself as well, to I don't know, at least keep that in mind. I think it's the hardest part in maybe in all of this, and maybe the hardest part of social isolation is that in a normal world, we get to sort of interact with others, and that maybe blunts the evil of the news onslaught to a certain extent, because you're not just trapped in it. But if you're trapped by yourself and you're constantly staring at that damn screen and just reading other people hyperventilating into a social stream of shit that is Twitter, I think that's perverse. It's perverting. So I do think it's just important to take a step back and think about these sort of bigger picture things, lest you.
Yeah, and maybe it gets back to the concentric circles of attachment and allegiance and loyalty, or whatever word we want to use, that, you know, at the end of the day, like our parents or family are the most important thing to us. And then our friends, and then our nation. Like, these are the things, like, what has come up when I think about what I've said tonight. I think that what stands out as important and vital are those things: family, friends, and America. Of course, the world matters too.
Yeah,
don't get me wrong, the world matters, but like, what I like what we're going to rally to and rally towards are those things. And then maybe this gets back to what you said at the beginning, Demir, that like, what is our natural state? What are we authentically fighting for when we're fighting for something? And I think it comes down to that: family, friends, and nation.
Mm. Maybe, you know, it's to save it for another time, but let's just throw it out there. Even though we are running out of time, Shadi. And that's the question. That's the other sort of cleavage I see in how people are talking about this. I think maybe you and I agree that, you know, the concentric circles is the better way to think about it. The flip side is people are saying, well, this clearly shows that, you know, we need to invest in more supranational competencies, that this is what pandemic shows us.
That we haven't come to that conclusion.
That we need world government. No, they don't actually. I think the people in that aren't stupid don't say that. But they do. But there is that sort of sense that this proves. Well, this finally proves that we are transcending these parochial things, and you know, finally, you know, the best of the world can technocratically govern us. And I still think that's just nonsense.
I think we're on the same page.
Yeah.
When it comes to that.
All right.
Wow, that has not been our response tonight at all.
No. Anyway, Shadi, this was fun insofar as it can be fun, but good seeing you in person after a couple of days. And
And I hope that our dear listeners will stay safe in the coming days and weeks.
Indeed. Best to all.
Bye.